bienvenidos. Yo soy Manuel y esto es Santas Herejías. Hace un par de semanas tuve la oportunidad de conversar con Josef. Él es un amigo sueco que viene desde hace un par de años trabajando teología, diríamos tal vez constructiva, allá en Europa. Tiene un blog que mantiene y también un podcast que viene haciendo hace algún tiempo. No sé si lo han escuchado, pero pudimos conversar un poco acerca de la aproximación teológica de él, lo que él llama teología desde las catacumbas. Fue una conversación bien interesante que les traemos ahora. Lamentablemente él no habla español, entonces lo hicimos en inglés, pero vale la pena. Si es que el idioma no se les complica demasiado, creo que es bastante entendible, así que vale la pena. Los invito ahora a que compartan con nosotros, con Josef. Tenemos varios proyectos así también interesantes que se vienen, así que los invito a que sigan compartiendo y sigan escuchando Santas Herejías. En todo caso, está la página web que Luis ha empezado a colocar algunas cosas, algunos blogs allí. Está en el Facebook también, si quieren ser parte de la discusión, o Twitter o lo que sea. En todo caso, aquí está la conversación que tuve con Josef Gustafsson. Okay, so I'm hitting the record right now.
Yeah, sure.
And we're going for it. We are here with Josef Gustafsson. Well, I'm here and he is in Sweden, where it's dark and gloomy for some reason.
It is.
Hey, Josef, thank you very much for taking time to talk to me.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
If you guys haven't heard his voice yet, he and his friends run a podcast called Freestyle Christianity, although I believe things have changed lately. Anyway, why don't you tell us a little bit of what Freestyle is and what you guys do up there, Josef?
Well, Freestyle Christianity started, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago as just my own blog, because I wanted to widen the name so other people could join in. And after a while, I started a podcast, and then Joel, another Swedish guy, joined in. And then after a while, David from Belfast joined in as well. And I guess we're doing a kind of expression of a theology that we create ourselves. I think of theology as this, as a creative endeavor. I don't think it's a way of trying to represent eternal truths. It's rather a creative endeavor. So we read thinkers like Deleuze and Bergson and Nietzsche and also many theologians that follow in the sort of aftermath of the Death of God movement of the 1960s. So we've interviewed many of those theologians, like, I would say, maybe Catherine Keller wouldn't be one of them. Maybe she would, I don't know. But we've talked to her. We talked to Jeffrey Robbins and Clayton Crockett and a whole bunch of these thinkers that try to develop that tradition and move it into, I'm not sure if I would say a second naivete, but some kind of progression in that kind of thinking that deals with the death of God.
Right. And that goes a lot in the vein of what we talk about and what we try to do anyway, theologically speaking. So if you guys want to check Josef's website and blog, will be thecatacombicmachine.com, right?
Yeah, and it's not simply my own stuff there. I publish stuff from other thinkers as well, people I find interesting, and perhaps people that I interview, I've started to ask them whether they want to publish something as well, you know, so that people can engage more thoroughly in their work. So last week, I published the first episode of this season with a philosopher named Peter Sjöstedt Age. And then I asked him, can you also send me a text. And so he sent me a text, and so it's published as well. And so people can really engage more with the stuff from the podcast on the homepage.
All right. Awesome. Hey, talking about that, you mentioned a couple of times this idea of the death of God and theology after God. And I was wondering what led you there? What kind of, something that we talk about often is that you can't really divorce life and theological thinking, that they both kind of one of the same as you live your life and experience different things, your theological thinking actually develops and change and why not. So being, if I understood correctly, the death of God, a bit of a starting point for you, would you mind sharing a little bit of how you got there?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a theology after God, but it is a theology after the death of God movement and the theology that dealt with the death of God in the Nietzschean sense of the word, or his line of thinking. So, yeah, what led me there? I guess, to me, I think this is something that is inherent in the Christian tradition, and that there are interesting thinkers that has picked up on this, and I would go as far sometimes even to provoke a little bit, but to say that Nietzsche was a Christian thinker, that you could, at least you can read Nietzsche as you know, the Old Testament prophets. They weren't there to sort of strengthen the tradition. They weren't there to just affirm what other people were saying. They challenged the sort of status quo that were in place. And I think Nietzsche is doing the same thing. And, you know, he would never accept that I would have called him a Christian thinker. But I think you can at least read him that way. And I think it's a fun way of thinking of atheism in general. You know, it's something that appeared in the West, or at least the atheism, when we talk about atheism, has a sort of Western flavor to it. And I think that you can think of atheism as a kind of reaction to Christianity. And, you know, generally speaking, it deals with the death of the Christian God. At least the Western thinkers that call themselves atheists. But I think we can move beyond the binary of theism and atheism, where they're opposed to one another. I think of theism and atheism as something which we are embedded in, and that we can move away from that binary and find a space where we are not trying to either represent eternal truths from a heavenly realm where God resides. And I don't think that we should think of man as taking God's place either, which is very much what atheists are saying. So rather than that kind of representational logic, a root tree logic, as Deleuze calls it, I think that there is a way forward. And that's not to say that there are a final answer to these questions, but I think that we can lock ourselves into what I sometimes call cathedrals, where we refuse to deterritorialize our own thinking. And by deterritorialization, I mean that we, maybe simply said, that we expand our way of thinking, and that we understand that our thinking is surface level phenomena, that we are not thinking about what the world is in itself and try to represent it, but that what we think rather is representations of what is. Is that helpful?
Yeah. And actually, that made me think of something that I've been kind of hinting at lately. This idea, especially with the, I don't know if you want to call it new, you know, deconstructionist movement or whatever inside Christianity and the churches, some churches anyway, how it kind of feels that they replace one absolute with the other. It kind of feels that this idea of deconstruction then becomes the absolute, and there's nothing beyond that. So yeah, that definitely was something that you said there to me, helped me in that way, that you were saying that it's always a constructive process, and it's always not necessarily just standing on the binaries of theism versus atheism, but that there's always something more that we can't quite grasp.
Yeah, I would say that the deconstructive process is always in the service of our affirmation of multiple expressions or multiple possibilities. And so the kind of classical hierarchical church structure affirms perhaps only the possibility of their own group being truly human, reflecting God in some way, and maybe an analogous relationship to the divine or something like that. But I would say that if you affirm differences, and if you assume that opposition presupposes differences rather than difference presupposing opposition, that will in itself be an affirmative move, but that will in itself also deconstruct the cathedrals in place or the systematic theological constructions that we have that we've inherited. But ultimately we come to the realization that the tradition that's been given to us, or the church that I grew up in, to bring it down to a more personal level, is just one way of expressing what it means to be a Christian. And there are other ways. Perhaps at the surface they contradict each other, but that doesn't mean that they can coexist and that they can both work in a sort of pragmatic way to solve problems that arise in our world.
Right. Wow, that's very good. That's very interesting. Now, you referenced a couple of times already this term that I see you've used a lot in, especially in writings and in the website. This term of the cathedral, and it's somehow it's opposed to the catacomb, and of course the website is the catacombic theology. So, catacombic machine. Sorry. So, would you mind explaining that to us? Like, how do you get to that differentiation, and what does that those terms mean in your thinking? The cathedral and the catacomb.
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm not clear enough what I mean. So I'm gonna try to really simplify this, but the cathedral mindset, as I describe it, works with a kind of binary view of the world, us and them, for example. And so I invoke this dualism between the cathedral and the catacombs simply in order to challenge the dualism of the cathedral. But the aim is not to retain a dualistic worldview, but rather to come to the realization that I was talking about just recently, that we are always in a sort of state of becoming. So we don't think of the expressions of our faith as normative, or perhaps that they're constituting, but rather that they are constituted, if that difference is apparent. I don't know, but I hope so. But the aim is not to just come up with a new binary pair, but to ultimately perhaps see God in all. Or as Nietzsche says, to simply be a yes-sayer. To Nietzsche, critique always comes as a consequence of our affirmation, at least good critique. I mean, you can be a reactive thinker, according to Nietzsche, and be moved by resentment. And he despises that, and that's his critique of the church. And I think that he is correct about his critique of the church. But I also think that within the Christian tradition, there are these provocative thinkers that sort of disrupts our normal understanding about what is Christianity. And so although I am very much a critic of Christendom, I am still calling myself a Christian because I do believe that there is something within this tradition that can actually liberate us from this sort of imprisonment that we've ended up in. And also, I don't think that really that we can just escape our culture, our language, our whole traditions and create something new somewhere else. But if someone who's a bishop or a pope or a priest or some kind of church authority comes to me and says, this is where the line goes, Joseph, you're not allowed to pass it. You're not supposed to move beyond this line. I think that my response is simply indifference. Because to me, the affirmation of differences, and in particular, perhaps my own difference, is what really opens up this space that I was talking about, where we can become, be in a state of becoming, but also be creative in our thinking and use our imagination as a tool for our theology.
Right, right. And from that a bit, you know, you said always being in that state of becoming. And never have actually become, kind of like come into that stance where, you know, there's no mystery anymore, but you have achieved that idea, which is kind of a biblical idea, eh? Where
I think this is part of the Bible. I wouldn't say it's the only thing is expressed by the Bible. There's always different traditions within the Bible competing within one another. But I do think that this is something that me being a good evangelical Christian found within my own tradition.
Okay, awesome. So you've mentioned Nietzsche before.
Yes.
A couple of times, actually. Would you say he is probably one of the biggest influences on this idea of this dualism that you talk about, the cathedral and the catacomb in your thinking? I don't know if you've referenced Deleuze as well. So I was wondering.
Yeah, I think Deleuze is probably the main inspiration behind that image, but Deleuze was very much a Nietzschean. So, and of course he wrote a number of books about different thinkers, like monographs about Spinoza and Bergson and Nietzsche and Hume and others. He and Guattari also wrote a book about Franz Kafka, which I find very interesting, about doing a minoritarian theology. I mean, that's not what he is writing about. It's a minoritarian way of thinking for him, but I think that we can apply that in the field of theology. So then comes Christian thinkers like Charles Winquist and try to actually use Deleuze's thinking in order to create a theology that takes his views into consideration. And so Charles Winquist becomes important to me. And then also later on comes those people that I interview on my podcast, like Jeffrey Robbins and Clayton Crockett and Noel Vahanian, as I mentioned before, who had Charles Winquist as their professor when they went to the university.
Right. And I wonder if you could maybe speak a bit more into that. And I've got to admit, I'm not like super familiar with Deleuze's work, other than, you know, the I don't know what you call it, the anti-Oedipus, and, you know, like those, I guess, main.
Yeah, but they're important works. So, you know, if you want to understand Deleuze, I think anti-Oedipus is perhaps not the easiest way to start, but it is a very original way of thinking. It is, of course, Deleuze and Guattari writing that book together. So you have Deleuze coming into conversation with this sort of crazy psychoanalytic thinker who was supposed to be the disciple of Lacan, who's influenced thinkers like Slavoj Žižek, but also Christian theologians like Peter Rollins, right? You know Pete, I guess. And so, I mean, it's a lot of names here, but it's all connected. And I, you know, to answer your question about Nietzsche, yes, he's very important, but it's not as if I read Nietzsche as sort of a final prophet. He's someone who finally completed how we think. Rather, Nietzsche's move opened up for us to be able to think again.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was what I was wondering a little bit. Because, again, you know, having experienced Deleuze in books like the Anti-Oedipus, my question was, how do you see that relationship? And you mentioned Rawlings and Slavoj Žižek as kind of examples of that. This interesting relationship that now psychoanalysis kind of is playing into theology, into the way in which we think about God and religion.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know Pete, and there's differences between our ways of thinking. There's a lot of stuff where we have stuff in common, but when it comes to Deleuze and Lacan is for me someone who speaks too much about lack. And so Pete emphasized that in his work. And sometimes I've said on my podcast that when Pete talks about us lacking, that's the wrong word to use. And he's been in conversation with Jack Caputo, for example, where Caputo criticized him for this as well. And Deleuze doesn't speak of lack, he speaks of excess. And to me, at least, I don't know if it's obvious when people read the stuff that I write, but I do speak in a Deleuzian manner about excess. But I also think that it's necessary for people to be in the cathedrals. And they need to emphasize the lack, and that's what Pete's doing. So perhaps it's not, in the end, a big difference between what we're trying to say, but we speak to different people or from different positions. And when I said that to Pete, he quite agreed with it. So I'm not sure, you know, if it's an opposition, but it's an interesting conversation. Because my understanding about what I name cathedrals is that they think that truth is pure and whole and harmonious, and in some sense that we live in this flux and that we need to break out of time in order to reach for the eternal truths that resides in heaven. So it's a kind of Platonism, right? And with Bergson, a French philosopher that I really appreciate, he says that's the wrong way of going about this. Rather than trying to break out of time into eternity, we need to recognize that our thinking moves in this sort of static realm, because that's how our minds function. So the true task for us is not to break out of time into eternity, but the other way around. We need to break out of the kind of eternity of our minds to actually understand that the fundamental reality is transformation. And so when you talk about this, you can criticize those who claim that the truth about religion is that truth is pure, whole, and harmonious. And in that sense, Pete's emphasis on lack works for me, because he criticized them. But in the end, I think that we can open up that new space that I was talking about, which I named the catacombs, where we can think in a new way, where we don't need to answer to what the high priests of the cathedral criticize us for, but, as I said, be indifferent to what they're saying in order to be creative and find new ways of expressing what it can be mean to be human and what it can mean to be doing theology.
Right. And that's a very, and you mentioned it before, I feel, or again, if I'm hearing you correctly, this this idea of after, of post-Christendom. It's very, very evident, especially, I don't know, in Europe, especially, seems that this is more than just an idea or a, you know, but it's become the reality for a number of years now. So it's interesting that you still bring that, I don't know, for lack of a better word, that, you know, you were saying we can't divorce ourselves from our religion, from our culture, from our language, even though we seem to be moving at least into a world where those things are no longer relevant.
Yeah, but I mean, I live in Sweden, right? And Sweden is considered as probably the most secular country on earth. I don't know, North Korea maybe. There are, but probably that would be considered as a type of religion as well, right? So Swedes consider themselves atheists and secular. But in truth, I don't think they've liberated themselves, or we have liberated ourselves, from the heritage of Christianity. And so for those people who've listened to the first episode of the Catacombic Machine, we've talked quite a lot about this, because Peter, who I interviewed, is born in Sweden, but he lives in England. He has family here, so he's only lived here for 4 years, but he has visited quite frequently, and he says Sweden is probably the most ideological country he's ever been to. And I do think that that's because the atheism of Swedish people is just this continuation of Christianity. Nietzsche, in a sense, breaks with that, and Deleuze and others, because they understand what's at stake if you break with the Christian tradition. Suddenly you can't say, I believe all people are created equal, right? And the thing is, you can't just secularize the Christian notion either and say all people are born equal. Why? If you look around, that's obviously not true. I mean, there's vast differences between the status that we're born to. Some people are born to be princes and princesses, and other people are born to be living in poverty. So it's obvious if you look around that we're not born equal, but still people in Sweden subscribe to the idea that we are born equal. So what do they refer to? What is this eternal realm that states that we're all equal? And the Nietzschean answer is that it's a lie. You're just kidding yourselves. It's not true what you're saying. Or as Kafka says, that the universal principle for your own way of reasoning is a lie. And in Kafka's work, you also get a kind of critique here that states that you don't really need to believe that all people are created equal. You just need to accept it, because that's how the machine that runs our world functions. And so Nietzsche and Deleuze and other thinkers that I oftentimes speak of critiques this, because they understand that simply to negate the logic of Christendom doesn't liberate you. It just imprisons you, and you're allowing for that old notion that you're trying to free yourself from to rule you. It's a kind of slave morality, or as Nietzsche says, also to be moved by resentment.
Right. And I guess that plays, what you just said, this, I'm not sure how to express it, but you're talking about this idea that these ideas, these themes, I guess, that the secular and, you know, post-Christendom society or whatever had inherited from Christianity, need to be more than just ideals. Now that we don't live in a world where, you know, these absolutes cannot govern our lives. These ideas, if we want them to be true, need to become part of our existence and not just part of our discourse of ideology.
And existence is becoming rather than being. So it's not simply to find a new kind of truth and says this is the new absolute, but to realize that all truth statements are simply these sort of simulacra, surface elements or surface phenomena that we have to our disposal, but none of them are telling us something about what is truly true, because there is no such pure, whole, and harmonious truth to be found. We've moved beyond that.
Right. And is that a bit part, I guess, the other aspect that I find interesting about your thought is this idea of material sacramentality. So I wonder if what we're talking about now speaks a little bit into that idea as well.
It does. And I should say that material sacramentality, I wrote a number of blog posts that can be found on the Freestyle Christianity page. It's not removed yet, so you can still find them there. And maybe there's some on the new homepage. I don't know. I moved a few posts so it wouldn't start from scratch. But it's a Swedish theologian named Petra Karlsson. And people can listen to me talking to her on the podcast. She talks about this. So those blog posts that I wrote were sort of a continuation of our conversation on the podcast. So I worked with her line of thinking and used, for example, Pussy Riot as an example of a material sacramentality, where you're not looking for the sacred somewhere else, but where you challenge the authorities, in this case, Putin and the Orthodox Church, by simply expressing something which they deem forbidden or doomed or whatever. And I think you can find many examples of how this can play out in various church settings, because you might be in a church where the people in power tells you that you're not allowed to be a homosexual, affirm the homosexuals, you know, or they might say that it's not good to be black, affirm the black community, or, you know, you can be creative about this, and it is a kind of sacred move. But it's not to say that you find the truth somewhere else. It's rather an excess that already exists, that you can, or perhaps you would say it insists, and where you allow for those possibilities to materialize. And so in that sense, you can maybe speak of a material sacramentality. But people should check out Petra Karlsson. She has a new book coming soon. And she even used these blog posts to sort of develop the work in her book. So it's coming out soon. I don't know the name. But follow the Catacombic Machine and she will be on the podcast sometime in the future.
Yeah, for sure. So let us know. So, basically, plainly spoken, what you're saying is that material sacramentality speaks to this idea where we don't have to look for the sacred in, you know, the God above and this kind of ethereal idea of what it's to come, or, you know, that comes from somewhere else, but that the materiality, the day to day, the mundane is what ultimately becomes sacred.
Yeah, because what is mundane is simply on the surface. There is an excess within everything that we are in, that we see, you know. Our conception of reality is simply a simplification of what reality truly is. And that's basic evolution, right? That's how we evolve. we have interests to survive and so on, to procreate, that moves us to, and to, you know, that it helps us to protect ourselves, to find food, to find mates and so on. And so if we simply experience the whole of reality at the same time, we wouldn't experience really anything, because it would simply be chaos, right? And so this is in some sense what I'm talking about when I talk about desires, that we need to understand that we are moved by our desires. So the catacombic theology that I'm talking about is a desiring theology. And that's also a little wink to Charles Winquist, as I mentioned before, because he also speaks about desiring theology. And it's about desiring otherness as well, but not only the other, but also the otherness of self. Because we are not in a static state. We're simply always moving, becoming, changing, transforming. And to accept that is perhaps not always easy, because people want to hold on to their true identity. And, you know, a secular version of this is to travel to India to find yourself, as if there is some true self to be found. And I firmly reject that as bullshit, right? And say, you know, that's a Western imperialist way of thinking of Eastern culture, because if you travel there, they wouldn't even affirm your way of thinking that there is this true self of that you can find.
Right. It's not that they're looking around in India to find their own selves or anything like that.
No, it's only Western people who are bored who travel to India to find themselves.
Yeah, that's true. That's very good. So Luis, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but Luis, the person that I do the podcast with, he's not here today because, well, besides that, he lives in Ecuador, but he's teaching an intro to theology class in a school down there.
Yeah.
So if you were to be in his shoes, if you were to be, you know, teaching an intro to theology class in first year of, you know, Bible school or seminary or whatever you call it, what would be some material that you would use? What would be, I don't know, say three or four books or thinkers that you will encourage those fresh minds to dig into for the first year of theology?
Yeah, so I would probably try to find a diversity of material, right? The thing is, the thinkers that I oftentimes emphasize are not the only thinkers that I read. It's the people that I think is needed to be affirmed, since there is already this sort of canon of thinkers that you are allowed to read in a seminary, right? So I would still appreciate, you know, to teach people to read Karl Barth or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, or, you know, you can go back in church history. I mean, there's an infinity of texts to delve into. So maybe half of that, but also something that challenged the view that there is this straightforward line of thinking. And perhaps also, you know, we were talking before we started to record that there is a quite strong Pentecostal presence in your country. And what I find to be interesting, you know, with Pentecostalism and similar traditions, is that they have a tendency to reject the whole of tradition and affirm, you know, the early church or something, and say we need to return to that. And I absolutely reject that kind of thinking, because what they're saying is simply, so you had the truth revealed once, and then 2,000 years of tradition where everything went to hell, and then God revealed himself to us, and now we hold the truth. So you need to kind of critique against that, I guess, because if you teach intro to theology, you must recognize that many of your students probably have come through these kinds of various traditions. So in some way, I would hope that I could disrupt their understanding about their own tradition, or their own traditions, I should say.
Right, right. Well, and I guess before we end, talking about, you know, Pentecostalism and that charismatic vein of Christianity that has formed in South America, I guess if I could ask you to play prophet for a little bit and tell us what is your vision for the world as seems that post-Christendom settles in and we move into a different stage of belief and understanding. What would you see the world becoming? What is your vision for that?
I think, I mean, speaking strictly to Pentecostal, I think there is a lot within the Pentecostal tradition which is interesting as well, you know, because there is this openness that many other people lack. Unfortunately, I think a tradition like the Pentecostal is sort of kidnapped by people that take advantage of other people's openness. So if I were to say something that I think could be a vision or a hope, would be to introduce people to thinkers that might disrupt their own presuppositions that make them trust these leaders that take advantage of them. Because there is no more easy people to trick when it comes to money and their way of life than people who are willing to offer up everything to a leader that tells them the new truth. And oftentimes these leaders are, I guess, romanticizing some kind of past. You think you can see it even in someone like Trump now, I think, in the American election. And we see similar movements within Europe where right-wing populists are using people's miseries in combination with their hope for a future and their naive romanticization of the past and making people to think that a person like Trump, who is this thief and crook and billionaire, is in some sense the right person to represent the working class in politics. And I think you can see that in the church as well, that super rich mega church pastors are standing and talking to people that simply want something to hold on to in a world which is chaotic and threatens their way of life. And so I do think that the theology that I try to talk about is a definite threat to these leaders, but not to these people. I do think that this sort of post-Christendom theology has the potentiality at least to open up for a way of thinking that affirms differences in a sense that Trump doesn't or megachurch pastors doesn't. And maybe that can be a positive message, but I'm not naive and I don't think that this will be an easy victory. I don't even think that we should speak about it in those terms, that we should be victorious over others, but rather that if we affirm that there are people who are not allowed to speak and affirm those people as possible worlds, that's a Deleuzian way of thinking of otherness, and hopefully if we allow for others to speak, that will transform not only ourselves, but also the world in which we live. I don't know. Maybe that's a prophetic vision.
Yeah, no, that's really good. That's really good. Given allowing, I mean, I don't know if it's allowing, but, you know, helping people realize that they're actually free, that in that future.
I think, exactly. And I think that's the key, because social justice movements all around, at least the Western world, has a tendency to nurture the identity of being a victim. And I think that's completely wrong, because they're too negative in their thinking. They're not creative enough. They're not affirmative enough of themselves. And I think exactly what you're saying, you know, you should, I don't remember what you said.
that's all right. That's right. But I like that. I like that. What you were talking about, that holding on to that past, to this romanticized idea, and if we could live in those days again, helps people not have to face the reality of a chaotic world out there. And I've always think that chaotic world that, you know, offers or seems to offer hopelessness should be the one that gives us hope, because at the end of the day, if there's chaos, then eventually, you know, we're gonna have to figure out how to bring order. And not order in a sense of control, but order in a sense of the chaos is not, of the hopelessness is not final, but that hopelessness brings hope in the sense of freedom. I don't know if that even makes sense.
Yeah, but I think it's good. You know, we have a tendency to position ourselves with people that think the same things that we think, and think that we are free when we can express our own thinking in safe spaces where other people would just affirm us. But I don't think that's the answer to the kind of problems that we're facing as a world population. Because the people with the power and the control over information and the money will simply allow for that to happen. So you will see people like the chairman of Apple saying that, I think that everyone should be able to go to the toilet that they want to, regarding this this controversy in America about transgender people. So he signed some kind of petition about, you know, transgender people that identify as males should be able to go to a male toilet. And so that's the surface. But he still uses the people as this prison factory in China, right? Foxconn. And doesn't really talk about that. So it's from their point of view, they don't care about if you protest the way Black Lives Matter is protesting, or feminism is protesting, or LGBTQ people are protesting. They will affirm that. But at the same time, they will oppress other people. So I do think, and I don't have the answer, but I do think that if we are to actually address these issues, like climate change, like genetics when it comes to biology, people trying to take, use patent on the human genome, when it comes to food and, you know, seeds, how people patent that as well in order to gain control over food distribution, over what we can develop our humanity to be, and so on. And ultimately we will be in their hands. So we are in for a real challenge. And I don't say that there is a final good answer to this, but I don't think the correct answer is simply to negate what they're saying and advocate the opposite, but rather, as I'm trying to do, to invoke a kind of dualism to challenge their way of life, but at the same time ultimately see that this dualism is only there as a challenge and in the service of our affirmation of differences.
Right. Yeah, that's very good. That's very good. And I guess we can stop there. Something that we like to do here in Santas Herejías is instead of try to offer answers to people, we prefer to see ourselves as help them start asking their own questions. So thank you very much for your time, for being willing to talk to me. It was really, really good. I can tell you that. If people want to hear more from you or read more from you, and where can they find you?
Thecatacombicmachine.com. And of course, you know, Twitter, Facebook, I'm there, Joseph Gustafsson, on everything, you know, every social platform probably. But Twitter is probably where I'm most active.
Okay, awesome. Hey, Joseph, thank you very much again for taking time.
Thank you.
A buscar acción y esos días negros y no sale el sol. Pareció una chica.